May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from harm. May all beings love life. May all beings awaken. Welcome to another Kyuk Audio Podcast. I'm DC, Poobah of Kyuk Audio and Kyuk Archives, doing our bit to help preserve the legacy of Shunryu Suzuki and those whose paths cross his. And anything else that comes to mind, I pray that you and yours are safe and comfortable, free from economic difficulty, and able to get out and do whatever it is you want within the limitations of the universal precept of do as little harm as possible. So today we have a guest, Steve Silberman. I think I first met Steve when he worked at Green's Restaurant when I was the maitre d', or host, there in 1979. I think that because of what he said in the podcast. It's been a while. So I'm going to read you what it says in Wikipedia about him. Steve Silberman is an American writer for Wired magazine that has been an editor and contributor there for 14 years. In 2010, Silberman was awarded the AAAS Kavli Science Journalism Award for magazine writing. Now, AAAS is the American Association for the Advancement of Science. That's very prestigious. His feature article, known as The Placebo Problem, discussed the impact of placebos on the pharmaceutical industry. Silberman's 2015 book, Neurotribes, which discusses the autism rights and neurodiversity movements, was awarded the Samuel Johnson Prize. Additionally, Silberman's Wired article, The Geek Syndrome, was focused on autism in Silicon Valley and has been referenced by many sources and has been described as a culturally significant article for the autism community. Silberman's Twitter account made Time Magazine's list of the best Twitter feeds for the year 2011. In 2016, he gave the keynote address at the United Nations on World Autism Awareness Day. Good Lord, that guy was just a waiter at Green's. Wow, man, he's something. And he's not he doesn't have autism in his own life. He's a real researcher, but there's more. I'm going to read you the rest because he didn't talk about this stuff. He's sort of modest. Silberman was born to a Jewish family. He has described his parents as communists. He studied psychology at Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio, then received a master's degree in English literature from Berkeley, where his thesis advisor was Tom Gunn, Thomgunn. Silberman moved to San Francisco in 1979, drawn by three factors, so that he could live a gay life without fear. Because of the music of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and the Grateful Dead, and others, and so he could be near the San Francisco Zen Center. He was friends with the musician David Crosby, with whom he hosted a podcast. Silberman studied with Allen Ginsberg at Naropa University in 1977. After Silberman interviewed Ginsberg for the Whole Earth Review in 1987, the two became friends, and Ginsberg invited Silberman to be his teaching assistant the next term at Naropa University. The Beat Generation is a regular subject in Silberman's writings. Silberman lives with his husband, Keith, a high school science teacher to whom he has been married since 2003. Then there's a long thing on neurotribes. He talks about it. Again, there's a list of awards, books. His first book was Skeleton Key, a dictionary for deadheads. And Steve, like to some people, that's who Steve is. He's one of the ultimate deadheads and sort of an archivist for the dead. And the second one, oh, he's only written two books, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. And that's the one that he talks about the most in this podcast. And he gets to the Grateful Dead stuff at the end. Anyway, impressive guy, really sweet guy, really like him. I remember when Skull and Keys came out, I went to some event. I don't know how I ended up doing that. I think because he was following Cuke.com and wrote me and told me about it. Anyway, that's enough. Look, we're going to give him a call as soon as we've added our pods to meditate. So when you hear the bell, if you're of such a mind, hit pause and meditate or whatever for as long as you wish. And when you're ready to come back, hit unpause. And we'll be here to hit the bell and end the meditation or whatever. And we'll give Steve Silberman a call.
Hello, David.
Hi, Steve. How you doing?
Oh, I'm in deep mourning, actually.
Oh.
Because my mom died.
Oh, my goodness.
But I'm okay. I mean, it's an interesting dharmic moment in my life, you know? She died last week.
Oh, well. My condolences, goodness. You've been spending time with her recently, I know, and she's been in hospice, right?
Her last years really were terrible because she had dementia, and she was very smart, funny, witty, pretty woman, but she lost almost everything towards the end, and it was terrible. We had to, never mind. But it was horrible. I mean, it was the worst thing I've ever been through in my life by far, particularly the last month. But her suffering is over, and different layers of my relationship with her are revealing themselves to me now. It's interesting for sure.
Mm. Goodness. Oh. Mm-hmm. Well, it's very sad. How old was she?
87.
Mm.
Yeah. So it's not like she died too young. She didn't. But what's sad is that she was just not happy at all for the last few years of her life. And she had been a pretty cheerful woman.
Mm.
So, it was just terrible. I mean, any number of horrific hell realm type things happened to her towards the end.
Mm.
So, I can't make light of it. But, it's interesting for me. I was her main person, sort of, because she only had two kids, and my sister tended to not get along with her. So, she was calling me 10 times a day by last year, and always, you know, the suicidal, actually. So, you know, it was really rough on me. But so now I feel liberated in a sense.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I'm very glad that I have, you know, had some kind of ramshackle Zen practice under me for all this time. So it's not like, oh my God, people die. Like, that's not a surprise, you know. But you know, yeah. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. You're here in Bali. We've been here. Uh-huh. We just passed the 10-year mark. I want to say something about your mother's passing. I used to be close to a really, really powerful psychic, and he would say he was no good at contacting people after they'd passed on, but actually he was very good. It was good enough, I'll say. And in the experiences I've had, it was always, oh, everything's fine now. Don't worry. It's, you know, it puts everything in another context. And also, thank you. They'll say, oh, thank you for, you know, being so patient and helping me. You know, it was something I needed to go through. That's the sort of thing I would hear. But I would also get very specific, you know, comments that left no doubt that it was some sort of content. Anyway, I just thought I'd mention that to you. It's always sort of good to hear. Anyway.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure you're involved with other things right now. You have this book, The Legacy of Autism. Let's see.
Neurotribes.
Neurotribes, right.
The future.
Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Wow.
Yeah.
And New York Times, Neurotribes is it's covered up here. I can't read it. Oh no, there we are. Neurotribes is beautifully told, humanizing and important. So, you know, I always like to start with anything the person might have for sale. Tell me about that.
Sure. Well, as you know, there's been a lot of debate in public life for the last 20 years or so about why the number of autism diagnoses started rising so precipitously in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And what I noticed, I wrote an article called The Geek Syndrome about Asperger's Syndrome in Silicon Valley for Wired in 2001. And what I noticed was that even 10 years after that, we still hadn't answered that question. So if you saw an article about autism in the New York Times, they would say, you know, the number of diagnoses has been rising steeply for several years, but no one knows why. And I thought, why don't we know why? Like, after 10 years, like, why don't we know why? And so they would, you know, find out that it wasn't the vaccines and that was a complete lie and all that, but they would never provide an answer. So I started, because of the email that I got from my initial Wired article, The Geek Syndrome, I knew that families of people with autism and people with autism themselves were facing really difficult times getting jobs, getting housing, before Obamacare, getting health care. That seemed to be the real issue, that people with autism and their families were not getting enough support. Meanwhile, the entire world was becoming obsessed with autism, but it was obsessed with this question, do vaccines cause autism? Which didn't really address the real problems that autistic people and their families were facing. So I went into history. I was a science writer for Wired magazine, and I started exploring the history of autism. And within the first year or so, I figured out that the standard version of the history of autism, as it was reiterated in thousands of textbooks and Wikipedia, was incorrect, and that it was incorrect in a way that rendered a couple of generations of autistic people invisible. And then they sort of showed up again in the 90s when the diagnostic criteria were changed. But I really wrote NeuroTribes because I saw so much suffering and confusion and public, you know, rancor around autism, and nobody seemed to be addressing the source of it. And I thought that if I could figure out that question about why diagnoses started rising so steeply in the 90s, that I could help relieve suffering around autism. And so it took me about 10 years to write, but I did it. And much to my complete surprise and shock, it became a bestseller. So that's why I did it, really, to try to, I felt that I knew enough, particularly after I did my reporting, to have some leverage to help relieve suffering. And so that's what I did.
Mm. So why is there so much more autism?
There isn't. That's actually the wrong question.
Yeah.
The question is, why are there so many more diagnoses of autism?
Yeah.
And the reason is, you know, to compress a 550-page book into two sentences, it's because the diagnostic criteria for autism have radically changed. I'll give you just one example of the many examples of how they have radically changed. Autism used to be just a diagnosis for young children. And it was mistakenly believed by the guy who called himself the world's leading authority on autism that autism was the childhood phase of adult schizophrenia. And that turned out to be completely wrong. So adults could not get an autism diagnosis until really the late 80s, early 90s. So that's one thing.
Hmm.
Another thing is that people of color were excluded from the diagnosis as well. Not only that, people who appear to be intellectually disabled were excluded from the diagnosis. And that, you know, intellectual disability is common in autism. So there, basically the guy, Leo Connor, this child psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins Hospital, was sitting at the top of a pyramid of ways of excluding people from the diagnosis. And he, you know, insisted that, it was very, very rare, when in fact it's very common, actually. It's a common disability. And he also vacillated between believing that it was caused by genetics or that it was caused by bad parenting. And unfortunately, he emphasized the bad parenting.
Oh,
stuff,
God.
Which made families hide the fact that their kids were autistic. So that's another reason why you never heard about it when we were kids, because people wouldn't talk about it because they were implicated in bad parenting if they confessed to having an autistic child. So, you know, those are just really just like, a small handful of like 20 reasons why the number of diagnoses started going up. But it's not that there's, you know, now there's much more autism or that, you know, is caused by pollution. It's primarily caused by genetics, not exclusively. It's a very common condition. And in fact, the guy who discovered it before Leo Connor, who was a guy named Hans Asperger, used to say, once you learn to recognize the distinctive traits of autism, you see them everywhere.
Mm.
And that turned out to be true. And the notion that it was this rare disease that afflicted, you know, upper middle class Jews and Anglo-Saxons, like that turned out to be just wrong, just bad science. So now we know that. And so now we can see, you know, some people say, autism is an epidemic. Yeah, it's an epidemic of recognition You know, we can finally see how many people there are on the spectrum in the world, and it's a lot.
Wow.
It's one of the largest minorities on Earth.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Do you have a...
That's what I...
Do you have a percentage?
Well, it depends. I actually don't want to say that because it depends so much about how the diagnostic criteria are in a particular location, but it's, you know, something like, well, let's put it this way. A friend of mine, it's more than there are Jews, for instance. There are more autistic people on Earth than there are Jews.
There's not that many Jews in the world, but...
There are some.
how many Jews are there?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know that.
Sure, have been a lot in my life. I mean, in my life,
yeah.
It would look like it was a third of the people in the world.
That's because you were at Red Center.
Even before that.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, I was sitting on a beach in Kerala, in India. In Kerala, people are very well educated. It's very clean.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy sitting next to me was a driver of a little tuk-tuk or something. And he asked me about Noam Chomsky.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Noam Chomsky is very famous outside of America.
I know. Yeah.
Then he said, well, what about the people who say that the Jews control all the banks? And I said, well... I said, I don't think so. But look, I said, in my experience, everything I've been involved with in my life, Jews have been prominent in it. And they just tend to be good at everything and involved at very high levels with everything. So being gangsters, being bankers, being humanists. Jesus, I was a member of the American Humanist Association, of philanthropy, musicals, Buddhism. My God, I said, so that's my experience. He found that interesting. Anyway, and wives, one fourth, 25% of my wives have been Jewish. and 50. Well, I'd say 25% of my sons, because Kelly, my older son, then would be half. Uh-huh. And because his mother's Jewish, he's Jewish. They just had a Passover dinner. We do that here. We have Passover dinners here in Bali.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. I've done them in Japan.
Great. Yeah.
It was where I've done it here. It's a mixed Jewish Muslim wedding, a marriage.
Oh, cool!
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. All right. So, moving on. That's so interesting, Steve. Do you have any personal experience with autism that made you interested?
No, I don't have autism in my family or anything like that. But once I, you know, as Asperger said, learned to recognize the distinctive traits of autism, I looked back and I realized that several of my close friends over the years were almost certainly on the spectrum. But because the diagnosis for adults hadn't been invented yet, you know, they were just thought of as weird or eccentric or standoffish or obsessed with, you know, thousands of Grateful Dead tapes or whatever. So I look back and I realize that there were autistic people around me, but they didn't have a name yet. And I don't have any autism in my family.
Yeah.
But, you know, the interesting thing about it, about writing a book about autism, is that everyone asks, like, well, do you have autism in your family? And, you know, I was a science writer. Like, it was a funny thing. I think it was a remnant of autism being thought of as incredibly rare. So it's like, well, why would you write a book about autism unless, you know, it was your daughter or your son or something?
Yeah.
I was just interested in the scientific question, but I ended up becoming very passionate about autistic people as a, you know, as a neuro tribe, as I invented that word for the title.
But, that's a cool name. A group, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. And, you know, they're a group of people with who, I mean, they're very different from each other. Some of them can't talk. Some of them are, you know, CEOs of Silicon Valley startups. Yeah. So there's a huge range of being and experience within autism.
Yeah.
But they are a community. And so I became passionate about pushing for social justice for autistic people.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the book has, it's a strength that you don't come from that experience. Sort of like, remember when I studied anthropology, they said that the best anthropology is not done by people who are in the culture. But from those from the outside. That's just one of the many facets of your life. So I'd like to get into the Grateful Dead, but first I'd like to hear your Way-Seeking Mind story.
Sure. I haven't told it before, actually, or I mean, I've told it in fragments, but I've never like given a talk like that exactly. But so I'll be making it up, you know, as I go along. But
that's best.
When I was very young, like, you know, fourth or fifth grade, really, I loved science fiction, and the science fiction that was popular at the time, this was the mid 60s. The science fiction that was popular at the time asked really big questions about, you know, the nature of consciousness and what did it mean to be an alien, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I started thinking about really big questions, probably from reading science fiction in elementary school. And then I came across the poetry of Allen Ginsberg, probably in a class in junior high school or so. I instantly related to it very deeply. And he, you know, figures later, you know, a minute from now in my story. So I was sort of just, you know, I guess seeking a way from a very young age. And then I went to see Allen Ginsberg give a poetry reading in Queens, and I had an experience that was like being struck by lightning. In Tibetan Buddhism, they would call it like recognition of the guru or whatever. And, you know, Ginsberg never liked to be called a guru and, you know, hated it. And it was a cliche.
But it was an
experience like that. When I saw him, I said, wherever that guy's going to be the following year, I have got to be there. And, you know, and then I found out he taught at this place called Naropa Institute at the time, now Naropa University. And I sold everything I had and went to Boulder to go to Naropa. And this was early days of Naropa. So it was really happening. It was amazing. You know, it's like at times for meditation, you'd see, you know, like 100 people like walking with their Gamdens or Zafus to the meditation hall. And there were all kinds of people around. And one of the people who was around was Taizan Maizumi Roshi. And Alan shamed his Beat Generation history class into learning how to meditate because Alan by then was a quite serious student of Chogyam Trungpa's. And, I remember Alan saying, how many of you have taken meditation instruction? And just like a few hands went up. And he said, you're all amateurs in a professional universe. I'm like, wow, that's quite a comment. So I signed up for A, meditation instruction, and B, my Zoomies class on Genjo Koan. And so I'd never seen, you know, a Dharma talk before, really. Trungpa wasn't even there that summer. He was away in Vermont, I believe, inventing Shambhala training. His Dharma heir, Ursel Tenzin, was there, and I saw him lecture a couple of times. But I didn't like the vibe of the Tibetan Buddhists at Naropa. They were all wearing suits. I mean, my judgment was very superficial, and now I know a lot more about it. But at the time, they just seemed like pompous, you know, kind of guys in suits. And there was a weird energy around Trungpa's inner circle. Now I come to understand. You know, now I understand he was a very powerful teacher, particularly in the early days before he was drinking so much. But
You can't say before he was drinking too much.
Oh yeah, maybe that's true. So before the copious amounts of sake, you know, really took effect. But in any case, so I didn't dig the vibe. And if you got meditation instruction through the Trungpa lineage, you would sign up and, you know, a student would teach you how to meditate.
Yeah.
You didn't see Ursel or whatever. So, but I heard that my Zoomie would actually be there if you signed up for meditation instruction and show you himself. So I went to meditation instruction. My Zoomie was there. I still remember the feeling of his hand on the back of my spine, you know, gently straightening it. And he had a very humble vibe. And I really liked that. And so I started sitting. And, you know, I'd sit in Zen style rather than Tibetan style. And then I took the course on Genjo Koan. And it completely blew my mind because I didn't understand what was being talked about, but I knew it was really important somehow. Like, my Zoomie would have these exchanges with his students that seemed so profound, but I couldn't put my finger on rationally why they were profound. And I'll give you a specific example. There was a phrase, you know, basically he would riff on phrases in the Genjo Koan. And that night, the phrase he was riffing on was intimate practice. And so he asked, there were like, you know, 120 people in the room or something. And he asked them, what is intimate practice? And then he started taking answers from people. And there were interesting people there, like I believe Bernie Glassman was there, actually. And so everybody from beginning students to senior monks would try to answer that question, what is intimate practice? And Roshi kept making this sound like a displeased cat, like somebody would give an answer and he would say, you know, like that. And he just kept going. And he kept going for like half an hour. And the tension in the room was unbelievable. And there were tensions in the room that I didn't even understand at the time, for instance. When he kept rejecting answers, I believe it was Bernie Glassman said, Roshi, you are drunk, and it makes me very angry when you are drunk. And, you know, Roshi kind of gave a to that. And then finally, somebody in the back who was literally in tears said, Roshi, my mother has cancer. She has to have surgery tomorrow morning. She might die. She's very, very sick. What should I do? And Roshi said, I am very sick. Will you operate on me? And it's like, I didn't know what the hell was going on. You know, like, I didn't know what was going on. But I knew it was really important. It just felt really important. So that was really the the moment that I sort of decided to practice. Because it seemed, because, you know, I had been told my whole life that I was, like, pretty smart, you know, for a little kid. I couldn't wrap my mind around it, my rational mind. And I couldn't wrap my mind around that exchange. I didn't know what was going on. And, but I wanted to find out. So I started sitting, and I still do. I sit every day. I mean, it's, you know, very modest practice at home, but I still do it. I actually now think that Alan shaming us into getting meditation instruction was the best gift that anyone ever gave me.
Did you ever have any contact with the San Francisco Zen Center?
Yes, I moved out here in 79 specifically to study at Zen Center. And I got a super cheap apartment at Page and Central in the Upper Haight Ashbury. It was $180 a month split between two of us. So every morning, you know, before dawn, I would get up and walk down. It was about 10 blocks, I guess. Walk down to Zen Center and sit. And I considered Richard Baker Roshi my teacher. And I loved his Dharma talks, I must say. And I know there's, you know, really a lot of complicated stuff around him, but he was a good teacher for me. We never had Doksan, but he was a good teacher for me. He had a way of, and, you know, now I understand that he was all involved with people like Ginsberg and Philip Whalen even before he became a Roshi. But he was able to come up with metaphors that were very effective for me. And he actually just came up with another one, like, not that long ago. I happened to be sort of browsing around YouTube, and I saw an interview with Richard Baker and a yoga teacher in Germany. And he talked about, when you walk around, don't think of yourself as a who. Think of yourself as a what. What, you know, ask yourself, what are you? Not who are you. What are you?
Yeah, that's I've heard him say that. I was in Germany with him. Actually, the only time I left Asia in the last 10 years. And he talked about that. I thought that was very interesting because I've done a lot of who am I. And I think who am I or what am I are interchangeable. But go on. That's interesting.
Yeah. So it was a distinction that made sense to my mind and also pointed beyond, you know, rational thought. And so So I was sitting every morning at Zen Center, working at Greens. I got a job at Greens and, you know, working like 50 hours a week or something.
What year?
Oh, 1979.
That's right. And I was the host.
Yep. You were the host. You were also a thorn in Deborah Madison's side.
Were you in the kitchen?
I still remember. Oh, yeah. Well, no, I was a waiter, but
right. I
also worked in the kitchen. I still remember the moment when she opened the walk-in and found you eating the ice cream that she had spent all afternoon making or whatever. And so it was a great group of people. I mean, I basically loved everybody who worked there practically. Deborah was prickly and uptight, you know, but she, you know, she was a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant chef.
Yeah.
I loved everybody. I mean, you know, Richard and Elaine were there.
Yeah.
Gene Hirschfeld was there. Dan Harvey was there.
Mm.
Like, it was a pretty interesting group of young people, you know, and I was one of the younger people, actually. I was a teenager, like 19 or something. 20.
Yeah.
So, I loved working at Greens. Loved it. It was one of the, you know, it was one of the best jobs I ever had. And I was making minimum wage.
You know? Oh, no, you weren't making minimum wage. You were making less than minimum wage. We were
Well, right.
It was 79. That's the first year. It was still in the slave labor era of Zen Center, which I loved. It was terribly a great amount of fun.
And I was charged with making tea treat in the morning. I still bow in every day. I bow in my house. After bowing in at Greene's. And I ended up getting married at Greene's. Because I had worked there and because I had such pleasant memories of it.
Wow.
And so we got married under the redwoods, the redwood thing. I had already decided to leave Zen Center for a different set of reasons when the Richard Baker stuff hit the fan. And I was never in the inner circle of Zen Center or the upper echelons or whatever. So, you know, I barely, you know, understood exactly what was going on. You know, now I've, you know, read a bunch of books. I still think Shoes Outside the Door is not a good book. It was like seeing family home movies where the camera was always in the wrong room. But a very interesting book is Philip Whalen's Bowed Some, Chanted a Little, which just came out. Have you seen that book?
Yeah. I haven't read it.
It's a wonderful book. And Brian Unger was there, too.
Yeah, that's right.
When I was there. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's funny to read back through Philip's notebooks because he was so, you know, sort of caught up in the palace intrigues of Richard Baker, you know.
Yeah, I've got to read that thing. My God, man. I got to catch up.
Yeah, you do. I mean, I think you're in it probably. But, you know, so I have nothing but great memories of Zen Center. And when the shit hit the fan, I wasn't really part of it. I left because of an interesting thing. Mm. I left Zen Center because I was, 21 or something. And I never lived in the building. I just sat in the morning and went to Dharma talks at both City Center and Green Gulch. Mm. I never went to Tassajara.
Wait a minute. You've never been to Tassajara?
No, I've never been to Tassajara.
Far out.
Yeah, I didn't. But as I say, I have nothing but pleasant memories of Zen Center. And I left because I was a 21 or something by then, young gay man in the middle of, you know, the summer of lust in San Francisco or whatever. and I wasn't getting laid. I was, you know, to put it more truthfully, I had no chance of falling in love because the only person who seemed to be gay around Zen Center was Issa, who, you know, I knew there were more, but
there were more. Yeah.
Right. But Ihsan, you know, was a doll to me and took me under his wing like a grandmother and, you know, would kiss me on the lips and was just a wonderful person to me.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, I remember, I got driven home by a senior priest whose name I won't mention. Every night, and we drove past a billboard for like the club baths or whatever, you know, some gay bathhouse. And I remember the priest saying, "Yeah, that's what it was like before Pompeii blew up." And I thought, Jesus Christ, why am I in this organization where there are not only no gay people, but a senior priest of all things can assume that he's only talking to straight people or something, you know? And so I decided to leave, and I actually asked Katagiri about it before leaving. I said, you know, I'm thinking about leaving. I just feel like I want to have a relationship. I hadn't had like a major relationship really, other than, you know, a few months college thing. So I really wanted to have a relationship and find a partner. And Katagiri said, your challenge will be to find something that means as much to you as in practice. And I thought about that remark a lot over the years.
Mm.
Um, And, you know, he was right. That was a challenge. But, you know, I ended up working in restaurants, which were terrible after Greens. I mean, you know, Greens was such a special place in so many different ways. You know, that working in other restaurants, I ended up getting a job at the Hay Street Grill that I had for like 12 years.
Is that right?
I did.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I did. But it was, you know, but it seemed, compared to Greens, like, you know, Greens was so special because of the practice aspect.
Yeah.
And also just because the people were so cool. You were cool. It's like everybody was cool who worked there.
Jordan, you remember Jordan?
Yes, I do.
Jordan Thorne?
Yes, I do.
Naughty Jordan. He was cool. Well, I want to say one thing. The biggest problem with Deborah and me, we had to work. You know, I was the maitre d', and I seated people too fast for her. And she was always she was always telling me, don't seat them so fast, because they couldn't handle that many orders coming in that fast. So we had that sort of tension. I don't remember the eating ice cream thing, and it's sort of funny because generally I don't eat ice cream. It's too cold for my teeth. But whatever was forbidden, I'm sure I was interested in. Another thing I want to say is I've had, you know, we occasionally have a visitor from the Zen Center realm, and I've had two visitors here in the last year who are gay men from that time who were not out of the closet then. And I was surprised because I was so close with Tommy, with Isan, and Dell, who were both sort of openly gay. It hadn't occurred to me that, I mean, and they felt very comfortable. And Dell would say that he felt very comfortable being at Zen Center because he wasn't, you know, his being gay wasn't a big deal. But that's not what the two different people who were here said. One of them, who was here not that long ago, he told me that he'd be with other guys at Zen Center who would make fun of, sort of make some sort of offhand, you know, remarks about gays or whatever. And the other said he just didn't feel comfortable. He didn't feel it was, he wouldn't feel comfortable that way. And I was surprised that both of them, anyway, I just want to tell you that. So move on.
It was a thing. It was a heteronormative community at that point.
Yeah.
And one thing that's funny about reading Philip Whalen's journals is, I mean, people were getting laid like mad, you know, and he names names. It's like he tells you who was sleeping with who. And it was a lot. And, you know, they weren't gay couples. They were men and women. I had a crush on David Schneider, who was straight, of course.
Yeah. That's funny. But who was ravenously sexually involved with as many people as possible.
That's what I hear. That's what I hear. They were lucky. I remember his Mets tap in the Zendo, which I thought was adorable. So, you know, I loved being at Zen Center, and I felt like, you know, somewhat that I had, I don't want to say it. I mean, I was going to say I had exiled myself. I sort of did, you know, at some point, but eventually I did find, you know, I got a boyfriend, not long after I left. I mean, I didn't stop practicing, but I stopped, having Zen Center be my whole life, and I stopped working for Zen Center.
Yeah.
And, not long after that, I met a boyfriend who I was with for like 10 years. He's now a famous food writer, actually, John Birdsall. So, you know, I have nothing but good thoughts about Zen Center, including good thoughts about Richard Baker, which, you know, can hardly say in public practically anymore. But, you know, so I had a not only a great experience at Zen Center, but it set me up for, I think, a good life in a way. Like, you know, not always an easy life in any ways, but I feel like it expressed my deepest values and still does. Mm. And, you know, now that I've had to deal with not just the death of my mother, but the disintegration of her mind in the years before she died, it was the heaviest thing I've ever been through. But it was horrible. We were super close. She had had me when she was a teenager. And she was very sort of scintillatingly witty and beautiful woman. And, you know, by the end she couldn't talk, and it was just the most horrible thing. But I do feel like Zen practice put under me a kind of seriousness and willingness to deal with whatever was happening.
Yeah.
There's a passage in Philip's journal where he's talking about getting transmission from Richard Baker.
Mm.
And it's either Philip or Richard defines enlightenment as, quote, all at ease with the way things are. And that is a really powerful phrase. Like, it sounds, you know, maybe superficial or something.
No.
But it's actually, like, it's deep.
Yeah.
Know? And
it's fundamental.
So that is right, exactly. So that is what I'm still aiming for, to be all at ease with the way things are.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
a little bit like the, you know, the AA thing, give me the strength to accept things I cannot change and
change the things I can and the wisdom to know the difference. Thing.
Right. I'm around a lot of that. Yeah. I forget. that's very, very interesting. Very good to hear too. And I hear, you know, Richard Baker, I'm in touch with him I agree with Mike Dixon, who says if it hadn't been for Dick, there wouldn't have been a Zen Center, wouldn't have survived.
Right.
And it's like I gave a talk, which was a terrible talk, at Green's. Oh, I don't know. When about the time after Crooked Cucumber came out, around then, I guess. And, you know, to the Zen Center people who signed up for it. I started off by saying I wanted to acknowledge Richard Baker, without whom none of us would be here now.
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad you said that. Yeah, I mean, I saw Richard returned to Zen Center to give I think Saturday morning or whatever, Dharma talk. Maybe it was about 12 years ago or something. And I went to that, and it was beautiful. So, it was wonderful to hear Baker Roshi's Dharma talk at Zen Center. And I realized how much I had missed hearing it hearing from him in the intervening years.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not a woman, and I didn't go through all that. And I also didn't – I mean, one of the things that struck me, like, in a funny way, because I was slightly an outsider, even when I was, you know, going to Zen Center every day, I was never part of the, you know, as I say, the inner circle or the upper echelons. And so I didn't have all these agendas, like, to get mad at Baker Roshi, you know, when
yeah.
I remember, like, people at Green's, like, would talk. You know, I do remember, like, many conversations at Green's where people were like, you know, can Roshi make a mistake? He has the mind of Dogen.
Jesus.
And, like, come on. You know,
God.
I thought that was ridiculous.
I know.
Just classics or cult-like behavior. You know,
yeah, really. Really, that we allowed that sort of thinking to continue to exist,
right?
What do you say when somebody is helping the alcoholic be an alcoholic?
Enabling.
It's sort of normal, I think, for, you know, groups to get inbred and have ways of talking and thinking and come to, self-congratulatory type thinking or whatever. I also feel that the problems we had at that time were like the healthy and, Baker had created a community that was strong enough to deal with it. And organizations tend to get rid of their founders after a while. I stayed close with him. You said this thing about you're not a woman, so you wouldn't know. Now, if there's a whole section on Cuke.com about shoes outside the door and a really awful review of it in the New York Review of Books that I wrote I wrote them and they should have printed what I wrote. Saying women were coming to Zinsner and being assigned to be his concubine, just complete bullshit, you know?
That was true of Trungpa's.
Yeah, no, that's true. But very willingly, that was totally out in the open. It wasn't any
secret.
So I did brief interviews with three, very strong women. My, first wife, Diane Goldschlag. Elizabeth Sawyer and Darlene Cohen. And all three of them said he never treated them with anything but respect. They never had any problem like that. He did not prey on women at Zinsner. He had one relationship like that. And I don't count the one that was part of his ivory tower group. All three of them had complaints about him that were other stuff, you know, that we didn't get into. Diane back then, when the three of us were together, she'd take him on. She'd attack him, you know, tell him he was arrogant and not her teacher and stuff. And he did just rolled off him like, you know, water off a duck's back, and he'd talk with her about it. So it's complex.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I felt like, you know, part of what alienated me from the backlash against him was that it seemed like people had all these issues. You know, was it the car that he was driving? Was it the fact that he was eating lunch with Jerry Brown and Linda Ronstadt? You know what I mean? Like, there were like all these, you know, sort of classist dynamics that people were getting really mad about. And plus, you know, we're all working for slave labor or whatever. I felt like a lot of things, like he just became a lightning rod for a million dynamics in the community.
Yeah.
And, but he was, you know, the community, I feel like the community that he created was my teacher in a way. In a way, it was him, but, you know, since I didn't do Dokesan with him, like, it wasn't him in, you know, intimately, as it were, but that the community really taught me and had a very decisive effect on my life that I'm still very grateful for now, and has helped me deal with the heaviest shit that comes down the pike, like my mother dying of dementia. Like, it has, the meditation and the just the right questions to be asking and the right things to be aware of have really helped me through life. And so I'm very grateful to you specifically for being part of that community. And you were definitely like one of the characters around Greens who taught me what real Zen life was like. So thank you.
I apologize.
No, I really appreciate it, David. I really do.
So, well, that is all great to hear. Now, you know, I remember, and, you know, I remember at some point I thought, you were, you know, I saw you and you were doing all this stuff with the Grateful Dead. And then, you know, you published something and I went, wow, where did all that come from?
Oh, yeah. Well, I can only talk for about 5 more minutes, but I saw the Grateful Dead for the first time in 1973 at the biggest gathering of human beings ever in history on the North American continent, which was a rock concert called the Watkins Glen Summer Jam. And there were, I believe, 750,000 people at that concert. So
wow.
It was like an echo of Woodstock in a sense.
Wow.
And the day before the concert was officially supposed to happen, the Grateful Dead came out to do a sound check, and they ended up playing a piece of completely improvised music that was one of the most beautiful pieces of music that they ever played in their, 40-year career, or however long, it was 40-year career. I just really lucked out. The first time I ever saw them was like a Everest of their creative spontaneity. And so I was like, wow, that was really good. I want to see them again. And then I went to see them again about a year later. And again, it was one of the best concerts they ever played. It was just a matter of luck. You can hear them. So I'm not just painting it rosy in my memory. It's like those are considered classic performances by them. And in fact, I ended up releasing one of them through their record company, the Watkins Glen Soundcheck. I ended up making sure that got released once I knew about the Grateful Dead and was co-producing their career-spanning box set. So I got really into it, and I got really into psychedelics. And, psychedelics was another expression of my way-seeking mind. I never took them just to party. I took them as a form of spiritual experience.
Yeah.
And so that was, and that was something that was running in parallel with my Zen practice, in a sense. I knew that it was not what you're supposed to do, as a Buddhist. The experiences spoke to me in some deep way. I just kept both going, going to dead shows and taking psychedelics and also sitting all the time. And they seem to even perhaps complement each other.
Yeah.
I ended up seeing the Grateful Dead 300 times, something like that.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah. And the first book I ever wrote was called Skeleton Key, A Dictionary for Deadheads. It came out in 93, right before Jerry Garcia died.
Mm.
And that was a big demonstration of transience and ephemerality, because Jerry died, and like, it wasn't just that Jerry died. It was like a rainforest of culture that sort of died, with him. I mean, there's still deadheads now, and they're young deadheads who never had the chance to see him, which is wonderful. But something, went away forever when Jerry died. And, by then I was working for them and writing about them and all this. So I ended up, I have like this kind of, hobby of being a deadhead. But it's also been kind of not a job, because it doesn't pay for my, living or whatever. But I've done a lot of writing about them. And there's a piece that I wrote, if anybody can find it out there, you can Google it. There's a piece that I wrote called The Only Song of God, which I wrote. It's an elegy for Jerry Garcia that I wrote immediately after he died, because I was afraid that I would start forgetting things if I didn't write them down right away. And what a Zen student would notice reading that piece, it's one of my favorite things I ever wrote myself. What a Zen student would notice is that the language is influenced by sutras. So it's like a deadhead sutra, in a sense.
Mm.
And I can send you a link.
Oh, please, please.
Yeah, I will. There's some typos, and like, you know, it got bootlegged and it's up on the web with some typos, but I'm pretty happy with it. And it was the confluence of my practice as a Zen student and my practice as a deadhead. I'm happy about that. Unfortunately, David, I have to go.
Wow. This has been fascinating.
Yeah.
I'll probably follow up with some email questions or something. Really fascinating. And I'm sorry about your mother. Again, condolences. And thanks for spending this time with me. It's really, really enjoyable. And, stay in touch. And if there's...
David, I have so much respect. I have so much respect for the work that you've done, like on Cuke.com and everything. I read it a lot. You know, I go back and read it or read, you know. You've done a wonderful job. Thank you.
Well, a lot of help. A guy named Peter Ford works on it as much as I do. He gives it better form. It's amazing how much there is to do with it, how big it is.
That's great.
I should let you go. Thanks a lot. And send me an email. Anything you think, I could also have talked about this, or anything you want to add to it, I can just read it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And have a beautiful day in Bali.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You too.
All right.
Take care.
Take care, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So thanks a lot, Steve Silberman. That was great. You're a really interesting dude, man. I look forward to seeing what you do next. You're really focused and have done a lot of great things. And you continue to practice. I don't know what to call it. I mean, I don't really think I practice Buddhism. I don't even think I practice. I just do. Maybe it's, like Rumi says, come all, even if you've broken your vows 1,000 times, come again. okay. This has been a Cuke Audio podcast. I'm DC Pooba of Cuke Audio and Cuke Archives, coming to you from Sleepy Sanur with Doggett Bandita, Feline Manis, and dear lovely Katrinka. And Katrinka's son, Seth, her daughter-in-law, Dakota, and our two grandchildren from them, Story Rose and Coral May. Great names, huh? We're all wishing you and yours a grand awakening. Thank you.